This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening. This is the evening edition. I'm Umar Pagan, I'm PK Pagan.
And I'm Ezra Zayed.
Now, just last week, Al Jazeera's 101 East program revealed how rampant baby selling is here in Malaysia. While the disturbing revelation left many in shock, some have come out to say that the country's current adoption system, which makes it a laborious chore for childless couples to adopt stateless children, is partly to blame.
But the issue continues to get harder beyond the adoption process. Applying for the child's citizenship is also another hurdle because the process, it seems, is often vague. Reports have surfaced about how some applications have been turned down by the Home Ministry after a two-year wait, without reason nor guidance about how to appeal the decision and what to do next.
So discussing being stuck in adoption limbo with us today are child's rights activists Dr. Hartini Zainuddin and lawyer Nizam Bashe. Tini, the subject matter hits close to home because you've adopted a child who is stateless as well. And before we go into details, could you help us give a broader look into how problematic the issue is and what's the reality on the ground?
Actually, the truth of the matter is there's a lot more stateless children than obviously is being recorded, simply because they're stateless. There are no papers or any way to be able to verify what the numbers are. So we don't really know. That's number one. Number two, with that comes a whole slew of issues that are attached to being stateless. It means you're not Malaysian. And if you're not Malaysian as a child, you have no access to a free and equal education. You have no access to health. You have no access to an identity, a passport, a way to go to school, to get a job, to get married, to own property. So it comes with a whole slew of other things. It basically means you're invisible. So, yeah.
And at some point in time, of course, this problem has been going on for quite a long time now. Has it reached a tipping point where, you know, authorities said, like, you know, let's address this in a meaningful way? Has that in some way happened yet?
I'm trying to find a polite way of framing this. And it's simply because it's personal as well, because I've adopted a child who's stateless, so it's very personal. The reason why is because we've actually have a policy that Malaysia does not have stateless children, that we do not recognize stateless children because there are none.
A complete denial of their existence.
Complete denial of their existence. Then you can't even define and try to lobby for protection. That's one. Two, if stateless children are not defined and we have no stateless children, then what are we doing going up to applying for citizenship, because we're already going to be rejected before we get there? We'll have to do simple things like, or how difficult things like, they actually say this. In certain cases, they actually say, please go find the biological mother. We're like, no, this child is a foundling, which means they have been abandoned, which means you're not going to be able to find the parents. Oh, I'm sure they're somewhere. Find them. You know, that's one.
Right.
Trafficked children, that means they're from other countries. I'm like, no, trafficked children can be from here. Trafficked children means their papers have been falsified, which means you can't even use those documents is getting the right information. They're stateless. You know, then you have the risk of statelessness and you have all these other categories. So it's a matter of actually getting the policymakers, the minister, the prime minister, the deputy prime minister, whoever's interested, you know, in the future and protection of children, to sit down and say, please listen.
So Nizam, from a legal perspective, why are they so afraid of? I mean, there's a common silly answer, which is, oh, you open the door to one, and then, you know, there will be hundreds and millions who show up. But of course, that's never the case. So why are they so afraid of recognizing these individuals and these young babies who clearly have no other recourse, and they're here in our country, nowhere else to go?
Well, I think we first must appreciate the fact there are policy reasons for their actions, yeah? And I think the bulk of that probably resides in the fact that, you know, resources are finite, yeah? So when you have finite resources, you must come up with a reasonable approach to dealing with how you intend to apply those resources to children in particular. Yeah, but I just want to come back to what Tini said earlier, i.e. it is almost as if there's no way to define who are stateless children. There are actually conventions or treaties which define what a stateless person is. And if you look at Article 1 of the 1954 Convention relating to the status of stateless persons, it defines a stateless person as a person who is not considered a national by any state under the operation of its law. In simple terms, when we're talking of a stateless child, it merely means a child who does not have a nationality of any country. So once you have a definition as to what is considered to be a stateless child, it doesn't matter what the state says. They can have their reasons for denying that this child is supposed to be a stateless child, but you have a definition that you can say that, look, this child, under law, is characterized as a stateless child. Mm. So then it's you know, we can, I suppose, proceed to the next stage, which is how do you then obtain citizenship for that child and whether the child is entitled to that.
Well, of course, I mean, that's almost what we saw with the case of Navi Murthy, where you're going to go all the way through the judicial process in hope of gaining some sort of decision. But, you know, for, you know, many stateless kids and, you know, for a lot of parents who have adopted kids, it must be such a convoluted process because there isn't one, I guess.
You know,
or is there one?
There is a process in terms of what you do when you adopt a child and what happens after that. The problem is the laws around the adoption process itself is convoluted. You have, you know, you have a 1952 law, adoption law for Peninsula Malaysia. You have adoption law for Sarawak. You have an adoption law for Sabah. Then you have two types kinds of adoption. You have private adoptions, where the biological mother actually can give up the child directly to, you know, the parents, the adoptive parents who want to adopt, and you have this process. Or you can go through welfare, and then you go through court, etc., etc., etc. Then you have who can adopt, whether it's a criteria of who adopts, who doesn't adopt. We don't have any standardization of who can adopt. NGOs can run around and decide who they want to give the baby up to if they come across foundlings or babies. Welfare has their own systems, you know. So it's very, very convoluted. And then you have Sharia and non-Muslim kinds of adoption. So
I'm assuming the different laws in Sabah and Sarawak are to protect the tribes and, and locals of Sabah and Sarawak, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And actually, as far as we're concerned, the most progressive, the most child-friendly, the best is actually the adoption laws from Sarawak.
After this, we'll ask Tini to break down the adoption process for us and just how convoluted is it. Find out after the break on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition together with me, Ezra Zayed. Alongside me is Uma Pagan, Ampike Pagan. And we're talking today about the difficulties found in the adoption and citizenship process when it comes to stateless children. Discussing this with us are child rights activist Tini Zainuddin, as well as lawyer Nizam Bashir. And before the break, we were speaking about the definition of statelessness. And Tini, you wanted to add on to that.
Yeah, the problem is we have international treaties and instruments to define, to tell us, or to provide a framework for so countries can follow. The problem is Malaysia is not a signatory to any of those conventions, and we have an article on the reservation on the right to identity for a child in CRC. So, with all that, they're invisible; they don't exist. We don't see them. So that's it. We're not going to protect them.
Hmm. Well, if I can just respond to that, I accept the fact that. It may be that some of those conventions, Malaysia may not have ratified or is not a signatory to those conventions. But there is something in international law that's called customary international law, which applies irrespective of the fact whether a state has ratified the convention or otherwise.
Can you go talk to the Home Ministry and tell them that?
I suppose it's probably most sensible to argue that in court and see how that holds up.
Can you go to the AG's chambers and tell them that too?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the relevant authorities who are involved. Which ministries are involved? And I mean, I'm just trying to walk through the process of wanting to... let's go through that.
Let's talk about...
The adoption process.
Yeah. The adoption process.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's say you find a child. Let's use my case as an example, my daughter's case. So we have a baby, foundling. And, you know, we suspect she's a victim of baby selling. So we call the police, we call welfare. Welfare is the gazetted child protectors actually appointed by Parliament to protect all children in this country, right? So they will be called in. And we go through this whole process, you know, finding out, et cetera, et cetera. They decide that I'm a suitable candidate to adopt. So we go to court. So we have the court. And so there will be, you know, people in court to who will act on behalf of the child, which is usually the welfare officer. We will have court advisors who will advise the judge on what to do, etc. This is whole process of adoption. You know, we decide, you know, 2-3 times we go to court, and then the court says, okay, you know what, we're going to let you adopt this child. The process should be then, if you go through civil court adoption, then you go, just go up to the National Registration Department and you show them the court papers and you say, the court says, I can adopt, you know, and they say, okay, we're going to ask the welfare officers to go to your house, do a home visit, make sure that everything's okay before we say, okay, we're going to let you adopt. But you're Muslim, so you're going to have to wait 2 years because you have this whole Sharia compliance on waiting to see if, you know, somehow the biological mother would show up if you're Muslim. If you're not Muslim, you can hire a lawyer, and a lawyer can actually fast-track your adoption process in court, and you can get your adoption papers, your certificate of adoption, 3 to 6 months instead of having to wait 2 years. Okay, fine. So there's all these things going on. After the adoption has, you waited 2 years, I've waited longer, and, you know, you go back to the National Registration Department, you're like, okay, I've waited 2 years, can you please give me the certificate of adoption? I will exchange the birth certificate for the certificate of adoption to show that, you know, the process has been done, except my daughter doesn't have a birth certificate. Why? Because she's a foundling. And you have to, you would have had to apply for a birth certificate from National Registration Department, which is a different department when you do birth certs, yeah, but it's in the same department, just different section. And guess what? You have a section in your application to the birth cert that says, if you do not have two witnesses to prove that your child is born certain thing, you can't apply for a birth cert. So now we've got a problem. So my daughter went for 5 years, even though we had gone through court, with no birth certificate, so we couldn't even do the adoption, and we definitely couldn't do the citizenship. So we had to go lobby with the Ministry of Home Affairs, me and 25 other parents, yeah? So this wasn't me alone, drama. It was me and 25 other parents, all caught in the same situation, having to lobby with the Ministry of Home Affairs department, different area, to say, please, please, help us find someone who is willing to say that you can sign the paper to say we can get a birth cert. That would be the welfare department, right? Welfare says, no, no, we can't do it without Home Ministry saying yes. So we had to go lobby with the Home Minister and the officers and the senior officers to allow welfare to say that it was okay for us to fill in our names, you know, as and say that it was all right, that we could apply for certs. So guess what happened? I was the witness on all 25 applications for birth certs because they couldn't. Nobody wanted to take a chance. Right. And the Home Ministry said, okay, fine. So we got the birth certs. Okay, so all this is done. We've got the birth certs. We've got the court papers. We've done all these things. Now we have to apply for citizenship. And it usually takes, they tell you, it takes about 2.5 years. There's interviews and everything. During that 2 years, at 2.5 years, you put in the application, you get a number, and you hear nothing for 2.5 years. After 2.5 years, 2 years, 2.5 years, you'll get a letter that says, you know, the process has been accepted and your child gets a citizenship or not. Out of all the 25 cases that we've done, none got citizenship, none. And they were not told why. And so we had to lobby again, had to lobby and find the officers and sit down with them to ask them, which was last year, why didn't the parents, why were all their applications for citizenship for their children, adopted children, denied? And it came out one by one. This one didn't have, most of them, didn't have a letter from the biological mother to say that she approved of the adoption. We're like, they're foundlings. They're like, where's the police report? We're like, the police report is here. We can't find the police report. We're like, okay, we'll give you another copy of the police report. Okay, where's the medical cert? Where's this? So it was just one by one. But can you imagine, I asked them, how many applications for citizenship do you have for children? 8,000. And mine was 25, took 2.5 years, all were denied.
So it seems there are two things.
And then you can reapply again.
Is this just complete bureaucratic incompetence?
Yeah, well, I think it's a lot of things. I think,
or is there just not a straight up?
Or is there something more sinister at play?
I think it's a lot of things. I think that the process is actually quite clear cut in terms of, you know, waiting 2 years, etc. The problem is you never explain to the parents what they haven't given. What apa maklumat yang tak cukup? You know, what isn't enough, and why do you have to wait 2.5 years?
You know,
pick up the phone call and say, you know what? We don't have your police report. We don't have this.
We have a checklist when we want to go and apply for passport. Mm-hmm. Bring these four things or we will send you home, right? Yeah. And as long as you bring those four things, it's simple. Have a checklist, right? Yeah. Nizam, I'm curious. The citizenship application process, so for anyone, is there an ideal path in your experience? It doesn't matter, irrespective of age, to apply to become a Malaysian citizen, how difficult is that?
How difficult is that? That's a hard question. I suppose my the only response that I can provide is one that's provided for in the law, which is Article 14 and Article 15 of the Federal Constitution has provisions whereby a child can obtain citizenship. Article 15A, yeah? And Article 15A is quite interesting because it's recently introduced, and essentially it allows for citizenship to be provided on essentially, any basis. So how that has translated into practice, I'm a little bit uncertain, and maybe Tini can perhaps enlighten us about that. But there are these provisions in the law. So
yeah. So I'm curious because, most countries, they kind of spell it out even on their website. Hey, if you want, you spend 5 years here, you do these things, you can get PR. Then if you're PR for like 15 years or 20 years, then you can apply for citizenship. I mean, do we have any sort of process like that?
I think the difficulty that we have is you don't have an act which sets out, firstly, the process. And that's perhaps where the difficulty lies. You have the provision, of course, in the Federal Constitution, but that only provides the basis by which a citizen or a child or a stateless person can apply for citizenship. But it doesn't provide for the procedures, the forms, etc. So it becomes a bit difficult to test that exercise. Yeah. So perhaps that's something that activists should try and sort of campaign for.
The parents have actually challenged the Article 8 using the Article 8 from Federal Constitution in court to try to lobby for citizenship. And the ones I know were all rejected as well.
Mm. The problems don't end there for Tini. After the news, she shares how another curveball was thrown in her direction, putting her daughter's citizenship application in further limbo. All of that and more on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening. I'm Uma Pagan, Ampake Pagan, together with Ezra Zayed, and this is the Evening Edition. In the past half an hour, we've been speaking about adopting stateless children here in Malaysia, and we've just found out what a tedious and vague process it is with our guests, child rights activist Tini Zainuddin and lawyer Nizam Bashe.
So, Tini, you gave us a detailed explanation of what happens in an adoption process based on what you had to go through with your adopted daughter. That included going back and forth to government agencies and ministries and being told different things all the time. And has that situation improved since, or are there still obstacles in the way?
Well, when my case got brought up, when I went to see the Citizenship Department, I was told there that I had to go back to the National Registration Department to formally adopt her, that the adoption through civil court was not recognized. Then I went to see a lawyer, and the lawyer told me that in my case, apparently, the policymakers had evoked some 1939 archaic law that said that basically my daughter's adoption in civil court wasn't recognized, and that I would have to go through the process again through Sharia court, and that the suggestion was made that I actually get the civil court to revoke her adoption and then apply again through Sharia court, which was so convoluted. And I actually, in all the hundreds of cases I've helped with adoption, never heard of this. That's actually where we are. Whether I'm willing to, go back to civil court and, get this adoption papers revoked and then apply again through Sharia court or not. And my answer is I'm not doing it. So
because I guess that you have no protection over your daughter, because
she has no protection, period. And that's where we are. And of course, because I've not done that, then I can't.
You're in limbo.
We can't do the application for citizenship, even though it's been there for 2.5 years. So they haven't rejected it. I haven't got a letter of rejection. They're just not processing it.
Where within this process in which we can actually tie certain loose ends? I mean, is there some sort of gap that is clearly obvious that either policymakers or ministry or court jurisdictions, is there some bit where we can actually, as a first step perhaps, tie things up?
Well, I would start perhaps maybe with the Child Rights Convention. Under Article 7, there is the right to nationality. So a child has a right to nationality. And when we're talking about citizenship, that's essentially what it is, that the child is entitled to be a citizen of whichever country. Now, earlier, I think Tini mentioned that Malaysia, when it ratified the Child Rights Convention, it made reservations to Article 7 and said that at least where Article 7 is concerned, they are not upholding the rights preserved under Article 7. But I think it's still up for argument in the sense that a reservation, it can be argued that the reservation is invalid because I think it is such a fundamental right. Children should not be denied the right to nationality because, as Tini mentioned earlier, there's a whole host of things that they will lose out on if they are not a national of whichever country.
Or they don't have an identity.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you're talking about medical benefits, the right to education.
Detention. Yeah? Possibility of detention.
Yeah. So even when they're dealing with the criminal justice system, there's so many things that are denied to them because they don't have such a fundamental right accorded to them.
And so we have these situations where, you know, when there are raids of any sort, then these kids are susceptible to that.
Yeah, well, you know, we're not allowed, there are task forces, obviously we work with the government on certain on protection issues and stuff, and it's just so much harder to talk about children in detention who are stateless. There is so much harder to talk about access to children who are stateless who need drug rehabilitation treatment. There's so much hesitancy in talking about protecting, in providing education for homeschooling, alternative education for children and who are stateless. It's a problem. And then you have that situation, and then you have the political situation, the political will, where, you know, we're talking about Sabah. We're not allowed to talk about Sabah street kids or that the fact that they're stateless and that they have nowhere to go. You can say they're from the Philippines and or wherever, but the truth of the matter is these are third and fourth generations of children who, by definition, under the UN, and legal instrument, are stateless. And we have an obligation, because they're here and this is the only home they know, to protect them. Protect them. I mean, you know.
So, Nitham, what rights do they have? What are the most minimal rights that these children have?
Actually, it's quite a bit. Because even if you look at the CRC, there's a whole host of rights, you know, even right to religion, right to education, right to know their parents. So it's a whole host of rights. But I suppose over and above whatever that's laid out in the Child Rights Convention, keep in mind that a lot of those rights have also been translated into an act in Malaysia.
Right.
So under the Child Act, yeah? So, for example, you know, parents of such children can disregard the welfare of these kids. For example, not even feeding or even protecting them, yeah? But that I think is somewhat separate from the issue that we are talking about today, i.e. we're just talking about identity, nationality. So I think that is perhaps the first step that we need to deal with. So
you, from what I gathered you said over the course of this conversation, it seems like there is a disconnect on two sides, right? There's one, there is a legal disconnect as well, where the acts need to be re-looked at again.
Sure.
And there's also a bureaucratic disconnect where even the existing laws that may help the process along aren't being implemented as they should be.
Well, I think where nationality is concerned, unfortunately, perhaps we don't have sufficient provisions in place, perhaps to assist in terms of the whole process. Yeah. So even then, you know, even when parents are faced with an issue, and perhaps when they discuss with a legal advisor, they perhaps also find difficulty in terms of telling them where to go or what to do next. So if you have this legislation in place, I think that will perhaps facilitate this entire process.
But you know, I mean, I spoke to some of the officers in the citizenship department. I actually had this running joke until I met them, that there were these ogres who were sitting there, you know, stamping and saying, no, 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 you cannot have citizenship. But you meet them and you actually do, and their hands are actually tied because of the way the laws, the current laws and policies are laid out. So they can't do very much. And they are trying to help us. So they're talking about reaching out to NGOs and people so that they know the kinds of things they're looking for. They are trying to.
So they're quite sympathetic to the
situation. They are. I mean, they want to follow the law and the policies are laid out as such. And, you know, they know that certain things, processes are not happening. But the final say on who gets citizenship, they only make the recommendations of who gets citizenship. The one person who's in charge of deciding who gets citizenship is the minister. So if the minister decides there are no stateless people, if the minister decides we don't want to look at the issue of statelessness at all, and we don't, and Sabah kids and street kids and stuff and are foreigners or children who are trafficked are foreigners, then you're going to have problems and you're going to have protection issues.
Could these difficulties be one of the reasons why childless couples opt for more desperate measures like going towards the baby buying route? And why does that seem to be an attractive option for childless couples? Well, we'll find out more after the break on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bruce Freddie Morrissey, BFM 89.9.
It's the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed. Alongside me is Uma Pagan Ampige Pagan. With us are child rights activist Tini Zainuddin and lawyer Nizam Bashir.
We're continuing our conversation about stateless children here in Malaysia and the difficult adoption and citizenship process they have to go through. Now, Tini, earlier you mentioned how the one person who is given the authority to grant citizenship is the Home Minister himself. Nizam, can you help explain to us how the law plays into all of this? What recourse is there for those who get rejected?
Well, the problem is the power that the minister exercises in the federal constitution on the question of citizenship, broadly speaking, is not reviewable. Yeah, it's spelled out in the part 3 of the second schedule of the federal constitution.
So if the minister rejects an application, that's it?
That's it.
And there's no review of an existing application? You would need to start the whole process.
Yes.
From the beginning.
But I would be minded to say that inability to review is confined perhaps to an application under Article 14. Of the federal constitution. Article 15, I think, 15A, stands, I think, quite separate from that non-reviewable basis.
Okay, something to be optimistic about. All right.
Yeah. Now, and Article 15 talks about as long as one person is a parent, right? Parent is Malaysian.
Article 15A is quite interesting in the sense you can apply for citizenship and the government can grant you that citizenship on any basis as long as the applicant is below the age of 21.
Interesting.
But there's a time period in which you can put in that appeal and review and challenge that, right? That's 3 months. I know because two couples I know who did it and they were both rejected twice in court.
Now, yeah. There's one thing that I don't quite sort of understand as to where it comes into this entire process is this term about baby buying, baby selling.
Yeah. The whole syndicate.
Because from my own understanding of it, wouldn't they just have the same process or problem that what you've just described earlier?
Are you kidding?
Well, if you
buy a baby from a baby seller, they're usually parts of syndicates, and the attractiveness in getting a baby.
Actually,
through,
Tini, before you say that, how much do they cost? Usually,
now,
how much does a baby
now,
cost?
Now, 60,000. It's about 45,000 to 60,000. It's gone up. Yes, it used to be 10,000 ringgit per kilo.
Okay.
So if it was a baby, it was just 7 years ago. Yeah, it was 10,000 per kilo. So the baby was 2.8. It was 28,000.
It's like going to the market. They're
no, that's
by
before.
The kilo.
No, now it's different. Now it's in US dollars. So it's 10,000 USD per kilo. So it's 30,000 if you're 3 kilograms. And if you're a boy, you weigh more. They're catalogs. So do you want, you know, what kind of mixture? Do you want, you know, Chindian babies? Do you want Malay babies? Do you want Indian babies? Indian babies now, you know, depending on whether they're beautiful, not beautiful, girls, boys, they're all by the kilo. No, it's not like that anymore. So now the going rate is about 45,000 to 60,000. But here's the good part. I guess, if you want to call it good part. The baby comes with papers that have already has the adoptive parent as the biological parent, and they're already Malaysian, so you don't need to go through the heartache that we're going through.
So, I mean, this is the attractiveness in which you're mentioning about.
Because
that.
You don't have to go through this whole thing anymore with citizenship and adoption.
And they're real papers, they're not forged.
They're real papers, real birth certs that say, this child is Malaysian, these are my parents, this is where I live, it's been stamped, the works. That's the clincher.
And how big is this industry? I mean, just to give a sense as to how
big?
Yeah.
Baby selling? Yeah. I'll give you a rough estimate of how big trafficking is. Well, the baby selling is not considered trafficking. It's still part of it. It's a USD $6 billion industry. 17% of all children who are trafficked come from this part of the world. 17% from Southeast Asia. 70% or so. Baby selling is the largest growing form of illicit, I know we're not allowed to say trafficking, illicit activity that happens in this country. One baby goes for 45,000 to 60,000, depending on where they're from.
Sorry.
With papers, yeah. So it's like pedigreed dogs or pets.
So there's at least $6 billion worth of citizenship stamps going around.
No, how it's trafficking. You could baby selling. You just, that stamp is worth a lot. That stamp at that birth cert is key. Ask me now. what I know, followed the law. I did. I followed the law. I told all these 25 other parents to follow the law too. Ask them now what they would do, and they would say, I would say,
what would you do?
I would have paid that 1,000 ringgit extra for that birth cert because I don't have to go through this. Unfortunately, here I am. I followed the law.
Now, it's more common than ever, I assume, in the way that you've just described it. Do the authorities know about
this? Of course the authorities know about this.
And have there been any actions towards addressing it?
The authorities would tell you, and you have to be very careful, and you have to show the proof that you know who within the syndicate is having access to these birth certificates and how are they doing a process. I have written in my police report how the process worked, what I was told to do and things. And depending on who the adoptive parents are, they will either tell you the whole truth of what you're supposed to do, where to go, which police station, where to go, who to see and stuff. Right now, because we do a lot of work on this as an activist, you can pick up the phone and call for a baby, and they actually pull up in front of shopping malls and at the back of cars, and you can actually come down, take a look at the baby at the back of the car to decide if you want. You've got 10 seconds to decide, and then they drive off.
And this is 6 billion a year.
$6 billion trafficking is a $6 billion industry. Yes, U.S. dollars. It's overtaken drug trafficking. It's much more lucrative because you can buy and sell babies. You can traffic a child for prostitution, for body parts, for drug mules and things. We're like cows. You can do whatever you want with us. So yeah, very lucrative business.
Yeah, there are a few conversations that we have where, you know, Uma and I just have nothing else to say.
Stunned silence, right?
And so what can we be hopeful of?
Yeah.
With the issue of statelessness and why I'm in it and why I've not thrown myself out the window.
Correct.
Although I'm a good Muslim. What can I do? What can we do? Statelessness is a man-made policy. You can change and lobby for policy changes. You can show and you can approach the issue of child protection from an economic standpoint. You can talk about the fact that, you know, to raise, you know, these many stateless children, and they are growing, it's better for you to do intervention and to give them some kind of rights where they're allowed to work, where they're allowed to go to school, where, you know what, you don't want them, let them leave the country, find an education and leave. Don't forget Madeleine Albright was stateless for a while. Einstein was stateless for a while.
Right.
So you know what? If you think that they have nothing to contribute, then let them leave, which means you have to give them a passport and some kind of documentation.
Or travel papers.
Travel papers.
Right now,
leave.
They can't even travel to Sabah and Sarawak,
My daughter needed special permission to go to Sabah for her cousin's party.
Folks, if you're as flabbergasted as us about how ridiculous these policies are, speak up. Talk to your MP about it. Get him or her to ask pressing questions in Parliament about why there isn't a more systematic and friendlier way to do this. These are the lives of babies, of children that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. A child doesn't know race, religion, or nationality, so why do we have laws that seem to subject them to such discrimination? And why should childless couples be made to pay the price for what is essentially a disconnect in the system?
And if you haven't already, do watch Al Jazeera's 101 East documentary. Just head over to YouTube and type in Babies for Sale. It's about the issue of baby selling in the country. If you've missed any part of this show, head over to bfm.my to download the podcast. Our thanks to child rights activist Tini Zainuddin and lawyer Nizam Bashir for addressing this difficult topic about stateless children and adoption. This has been The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.